because we're so grateful and delighted that you could come. When I was listening to the story about the donkey and getting hoisted out into the donkey, I thought we were marginally close to that donkey yesterday, everybody here. So it's truly heroic. But apart from the fact that we're really happy you're here, and we hope you are happy with the talks and have a good time, we genuinely feel that energetically something is going on, and your being here, your presence, is co-partnering us in our efforts. So whether it's for 3 days, whether it's for 3 weeks, whatever that time is, we feel that that is essential in the lightening of the soil or the earth's field around Shihoof. When Paul and I came nearly a year and a half ago, it wasn't quite like walking into a tomb, but it was dark and it was cold and the walls were unfriendly and we had bad dreams and we had upset tummies, and you know, it's taken quite a few months into the second year now that we find that conferences such as this, the summer we had children who came and played, as I said, played in the water, played in the surrounding yards and things, and they just laughed and laughed and laughed, and you can just begin to feel the lightness around Shihoof, whereas I can tell you it doesn't have a light history. So, that said, thank you again, truly, and I'm going to sit down. Okay. Today we will be looking at the ancestor syndrome, transgenerational psychotherapy, and the hidden links in the family tree. And this was written by Anne Anselin Schustenberger. Schustenberger asserts that in order to really understand a person or an individual, we must define him or her by the full scope of his or her needs, obligations, commitments, and responsible attitudes in the family relational field over several generations. If we consider families as living systems, then it doesn't make sense that the death of one family member means the death of the family as a living system. One dead tree, for example, does not wipe out the entire forest. But what about a whole generation? Can a whole generation mean extinction for the family as a living system? I don't think so, any more than anything else in nature that regenerates itself can die out completely. If nothing else, it transforms itself. When looking at families, specifically to what Schustenberger calls hidden links, she can show how patterns within respective families repeat themselves generation after generation. One of the ways we identify a living system is to look at their patterns or their habits, if you will. And I'd like to use the Kinevich family tree as an example, and hopefully by the end of this talk, it will become clear how, over the course of 5 generations, the dominant pattern of forced exile creates within the system not only an imposed physical state of refugee status, but a psychological one as well. This pattern of exile has shaped some of the psychological subtleties with which descending generations must cope, such as a sense of rootlessness, a paranoia that the land you do own or the property you lease will be taken from you, even though there is no threat of any such thing happening, and in general, a feeling of something out to get you, thus constellating the need to hide or keep fleeing. Something I don't have time to discuss at length, but something Schustenberger calls anniversary deaths, and in some cases double anniversary syndrome, is certainly worth looking into if you're interested in this kind of family pattern. If it plays out in your particular family dynamic, it's worth exploring. Quickly, though, as an example of what her research regarding anniversary deaths tells us, Simone de Beauvoir died on the night of April 16, 1986, the date within a few hours of Jean-Paul Sartre, who died on April 15, 1980. The same date within a few hours of each other on the night between the 15th and the 16th. On November 22, 1963, John F. Kennedy chose to drive through Dallas with the bulletproof roof of his car down, having forgotten, she has in quotes, both the death threats and that the father of his grandfather, Patrick, had died on November 22, 1858. He had forgotten the event without forgetting to take risk. But today I want to focus on this single pattern of exile, which shows up in Paul's family for over five generations, and then ultimately link this pattern to a nation such as Poland and its sustained trauma and wounds. Schustenberger writes, "What haunts are not the dead, but the gaps left within us by the secrets of others. It is a secret that cannot be told, often a parent's shameful secret, a loss, an injustice. By hiding, this unspeakable grieving settles inside, in a secret tomb, in a crypt. On the drive outside the window, just here, is the one the Nazis used to take Sophia and Christopher Givio to the camps. She went to Ravensbrück, and although released after 1 year, she suffered from bouts of anxiety and depression the rest of her life. He also survived Majdanek, but not unscathed. On that day, the children were left behind in a huddle, crying, just in this room, which was at one time their master bedroom, left here next to us. And the psychological lives of these children, shaped by the influence of war and the trauma they suffered, is still discernible right into the third generation, still a living system, despite the passing of parents and grandparents. Sophia Reggio, which is, and she's not here pictured, the daughter of Sophia Reggio, is the last surviving one of the five children. And Paul and I went to visit her in Warsaw a few months ago. And she was the one who encouraged the rebuilding of Shihup. She is the one who said, you must rebuild Shihup. And all she can say is, why can't everybody just love each other? And of course, this endless stories about her memories of the war. Schustenberger's research tells us that transgenerational transmissions are not spoken about. They're kept secret, they're quiet in some cases, not just as a secret, but actually banned from thought. The unthinkable passed down from generation to generation without being thought about and certainly not assimilated. Jung would say the collective unconscious shapes who we are. And it is this unconscious that transmits from generation to generation. This phenomenon, according to psychoanalyst Bruno Bettelheim, must be talked about because what cannot be talked about can also not be put to rest. And if it is not, the wounds continue to fester from generation to generation because the world must know how they, the children of Holocaust, for example, have been marked by this deportation through to the third generation. It's horrible. One of our more recent guests shared with us a quote from a friend of hers, an aging Polish soldier who still visits the primary schools around Warsaw, and he said, "I try to speak not only of facts, but also to convey the mood of those years, the smell of the woods, the soil, the leaves, the smoke of others, and especially the feelings of friendship during times of trial, whether in the midst of combat or everyday life, often cold and hungry, fighting for Poland's independence deep in the woods. I feel the need to make an addition to this quote by telling you that Polish Jews were systematically rounded up for deportation or executed on the spot in the neighboring woods around Szczytów. According to surviving witnesses, the streets literally ran with blood, what can't be talked about. By hiding this unspeakable grieving, it settles inside in a secret tomb in a crypt. Nie zapomnij Wójcia. Don't forget Wójcia. Paul's mother said over and over again on her deathbed, clutching tight to the framed photograph of her childhood home. This photograph, by the way, you're welcome to see it, sits above the fireplace in the reading room upstairs at the pension where we meditated this morning. This was her unspeakable grief for having her dreams aborted by war, exile at the age of 25, uprooted. Don't forget Wójcia. Schustenberger has observed that historical wounds remain open wounds. And I can think of no better place than Poland where this assertion is so noticeably evident. It is not only World War II, but the subsequent communist domination that the second and third generations carry, but it is the complicated and precarious nature of Poland's fierce struggle for democracy and independence. In Paul's father's memoirs, Henryk Kiniewicz writes, Poland and the Catholic Church only remained alive behind the closed doors of the Polish manor houses, and that was the difference between Tsarist and Bolshevik persecution, for the former stopped at the front door of your house. There is a childhood poem that even a three-year-old can cite here in Poland called Kto to jesteś? Who are you? Czym za ziemię? What is that soil? Mam ojczyzna. No, my fatherland. Czym zdobyta? How was it gained? Krwią I blizną. Through blood and scars. This is the land of Paul's ancestors. The soil, the trees, the flowers that bloom here, the fields, this landscape, and its language were predominant in the family narrative. As refugees, his parents carried with them the stories of Poland, their language, and their recipes. The language at the table were the two cornerstones of Paul's childhood that kept him connected to what he described as this strange and elusive place called Poland. But so also were the hidden, the unspoken, and the gaps Dr. Schustenberger references in her research. In her words, we can see, perceive, or sense these complex links, although generally we do not speak about them. We experience them as part of the realm of the unspeakable, the unthinkable, the unvoiced of the secret. I come to this family by marriage, but I believe I also come by a will within, a kind of destiny that I'm not sure I completely understand. But here we are, this marriage of Paul and myself, here together at Szczytów, perhaps to right a wrong, perhaps to see justice done. Who knows? Dr. Schustenberger remarked how founding psychotherapists of the transgenerational approach all share an Eastern European or Central European origin. I quote, in Eastern and Central European countries, such as in Russia among Slavs, just as among Mediterranean peoples, the family forms a very strong social atom, a nest, a close-knit clan, a womb from which an individual builds his or her own identity. She tells us about the family balance sheet, on which indicates either a credit or debit status, obligations, loyalties, specifically about the concept of justice, family justice, suggesting that when there is an injustice, unfairness, and or exploitation on family members, or done to family members, that this can sometimes translate into fleeing, rebelling, ledgers don't balance, then problems can be passed on from generation to generation. She also points out the difficulty, and I would propose impossibility in some cases, in understanding transgenerational links, specifically the family balance sheet, because nothing is straightforward, as every family has their own definition of family loyalty and justice. Transgenerational psychotherapy is in no way an objective concept, but it is persuasive after reading through the author's research and discoveries. But to really understand the transgenerational links, it is necessary to create a visual representation of family history over three, preferably five generations, and this visual is called a genosociogram. I don't know if I have, we're going to use the family tree here, or part of it, but I don't know if we have
a picture. No, I don't think we have.
If we don't, I can pass it on the book. Here we see examples of Schustenberger's simplified genosociograms from her client research. Now, I'm working, as I said just now, with his family tree, photographs and memoirs dating back to Paul's grandfather, using this as an example in identifying patterns and the hidden links in the family system. Not everyone is so fortunate to have such a treasure trove of information, thus the genosociogram was created. So Schustenberger would work in group therapy with her clients, and she would take a specific narrative just from the patient and build a genosociogram, because there was very little really memoirs or stories or narrative or anything for the client to actually access, so they managed to do it this way. But she talks about the multi-purposes of the genosociogram. One, to discover that the world did not begin with our own parents, that they too are the fruit of a world that began to exist long before them, which means to situate oneself in a transgenerational perspective and to start researching one's roots and identity. And two, to bring out transgenerational transmission processes and phenomena of transgenerational repetition. For example, through invisible family loyalties, family secrets, family myths, synchronicity, and the anniversary syndrome. To understand the effects of unfinished grieving, the effects of the unspoken, are just a few. Fred Gustafsson, Jungian analyst, writes, "It is a hidden and silent grief, barely visible, pushed aside and buried, layer upon layer, by the cultural and personal justifications for survival. It is a grief that binds victim and perpetrator in an unconscious alliance, beyond the hatred, beyond the blame, beyond the guilt, in a sense of mutual sharing, namely that both are victims of a common grief, can only be healed when acknowledged." And I might also add that I feel that the importance of these genosociograms is a tool that can help a person in the psychological process of establishing his or her own personal authority through means of bringing to consciousness certain patterns, bits of information that have hitherto been dominant, or dormant rather, and once revealed have the power to heal. So let's introduce Paul's family. This is Antoni Nestor Kinyuj. That was Paul's great-great-grandfather. And these two were, his wife, we don't know her first name, but she came from the, let's see if I have this here just at hand. Yes, she came from the Lithuanian Odinsuvna, is that his name?
Mm-hmm.
Family, and they both died tragically young. She, it was rumored, committed suicide by drowning herself in the Pripyat River. Now, let me, so that's just a little clue into that. that's really about all we have from the great-great-grandfather, except for the property that he amassed in a place called Derchevicha. Do we have a picture of the next slide of Derchevicha? Uh-huh. So this was Derchevicha in a place, it was in Belarus area, which was Russia, which was Poland and is now Russia. One is the artistic rendition of one of the sons. So Paul's grandfather, also named Antoni, he and his wife Magdalena had four boys, one of whom was Paul's father, Henry. This was an artistic rendition by one of the brothers. This was actually a photograph. But let me just go here and say also something about Paul's mother, who was a Popio. Her family lived only about 30 minutes away by car, but by britchka, horse and carriage, was certainly longer, 30 minutes away from Shiv. So that's a bit of curiosity belonging to this building. And in digression, Paul's maternal grandparents, when they visited Shiv, stayed in this room at the end of this building where the cathedral windows are. And it's noted in the archives here that Michael, or Michal, who was Paul's grandfather, could outshoot his host, Shostakovich. He was quite proud of that. And another interesting fact as well is that Paul's father, who was an estate manager, and it's easy to see how he came into this business, an estate manager would come here to Shihuf and actually study the operation of the manor house before the war. So in 1820, the property was divided between the sons. The eldest Hieronym, now we have a lot of Antonis and a lot of Hieronyms, it's like Mary Magdalene and all the Marys in the Bible, it's very difficult to keep up with, but the eldest Hieronym was Paul's great-great-grandfather, and his brother, Felix, who, according to Henrik's memoirs, in 1930, the November insurrection breaks out and Lithuania wants the world to know that the partitions of Poland have not ruptured the union with Poland and that we make common cause with the Poles in wanting to throw off the foreign yoke. Felix becomes a representative in this uprising, but after its failure must escape across the border to France, where he settles in exile for long years to come. He only returns after the death of Tsar Nicholas I. So we will see the relationship played out again with Paul's grandfather, also named Antoni, and his brother Hieronym, Paul's great uncle, who risked the family fortune and committed suicide as a result. Thank you, darling. Thank you. Certainly a kind of exile or fleeing.
These are my parents. I'm here. Over here is Antoni, my grandfather. And here is Felix.
That's the first Felix.
Exiled
into France.
In the first uprising. And there is my great grandfather. And that's the way that the man's my grandfather.
Sorry, that's the first two.
Other players of note are Hieronym and Adiela, who is my grand uncle, and about which I will speak no doubt at the meeting. But those are some of the players that we're talking about.
Why were they exiled? Why were they exiled?
Well, because there was an uprising against the Russians in 1830, where the Poles tried to throw off the Russians and become independent, because at the time there wasn't a political entity called Poland. It had disappeared in 1795, part of it taken by the Russians, part by the Prussians, and part by the Austro-Hungary Empire. And this was an insurrection against the Russians, which was a disaster for the Poles. And Tsar Nicholas threatened to burn Warsaw down. And basically, Felix had to run for it. And then later on.
Yeah, so it's Felix was just, yeah, there's only one Felix. His brother was Hieronym, and Felix's son was named after his uncle Hieronym. And this is in 1863, so 30 years later.
This is the other one who also had a.
Yeah, so you see that a new insurrection rather against the Russians break out. And once again, the more impetuous Poles living in Lithuania and the Ukraine take up arms. Now the elder generation, which would have been Felix and his brother Hieronym, having already experienced this, try to dissuade the younger ones to keep home. But Felix's son Hieronym goes to fight, and of course he pays with his life. An example of transgenerational repetition.
He's executed, actually.
Oh, he was. Once again, the tragedy for the Polishness of these lands. Disgusted by the ensuing enslavement, Paul's great-great-grandparents chose exile in Rome, where they died and are buried in the Campo Verano Cemetery. And to this very day, family members clean these graves. So this is, I don't know how many generations, four or five. And they go and just cousins, you know, extended family keep this grave clean. Now, coming closer to Paul, Antoni Kinievich, again, married Magdalena Grabowski, which Paul just showed you, those were his grandparents. And according to Henry's memoirs, Paul's father, were blissfully happy in married life. So if debts are transferable, likewise so are credits. The folklore in the Kinievich family is that all the Kinievich men are devoted to their wives, and I can certainly confirm this. The Derchevice Chapel, which I don't have a picture of, was sealed and entry was forbidden. It was only in 1890 that Henry's grandmother, Jadwiga Horvath, who would have been over here some, Jadwiga, here she is, Jadwiga Horvath, and she is the mother of this Hieronym, and both of them committed suicide. He committed suicide, I'll tell you in just a minute how or why. He committed suicide, and then a year later she committed suicide. But she was quite religious, and which surprises me that she would have taken her life, but she got a special permission from the government for mass to be said twice a year in the chapel, and only solely masses for the dead. And I only mention this because of Poland's, the people of Poland desperately trying to hold on to their religion, desperately trying to hold on to their language, desperately trying to hold on to their culture. And if you come to Poland today and you say, oh my God, this Catholic Church, which is very impressive in my opinion, I think it just, you know, again, it's historically, it dates back to this time when you had to come up against such huge, you know, monarchs and powers in order to get anything, in order to hang on to anything Polish. Henry Kinievich writes, Catholic religious instruction was forbidden in schools and you were expelled for speaking in Polish. As I said earlier, Poland and the Catholic Church were protected and consequently survived from behind the closed doors of the Polish manor houses. Now, Derchevice was managed by Paul's great-grandfather Hieronym, his grandfather Antoni, and his brother, Paul's great-uncle Hieronym. Henry writes in his memoirs that while the men were generally harnessed into the daily routine of tasks, duties, cares, and concerns, when in the morning they stepped outside, they would go deep into the huge forest which they loved and which spoke to them with 1,000 enchantments. And I think it's interesting because, you know, Paul, even a day didn't pass that I've known him, that he doesn't seek out some patch of tree or some forest, some place, and that's really quite ambitious in Houston, Texas, to find this, and he would always find a tree to go sit under somewhere on his lunch break, or and even today, every day, he walks in the trees. Henry also tells us that he can remember and talk about the First World War and his time, but the outbreak of it did not have much of an effect on life at Der Chimucha. It was only after the fall of Warsaw in 1915 and the collapse of the front that waves of refugees started to flow east. And at this point, the house filled up with family refugees. You see this refugee filling up houses again when you go to Ruzhcha, and we'll come to that picture in a few minutes. During this time, the house where Paul's father Henry and his parents and his brothers lived went up in flames. They lost everything, but fortunately then moved into the larger estate at Der Chimucha. So that's the first time Henry lost everything he owned. Next year, 1917, brought the complete collapse of the Russian army, making space for the Russian Revolution. Henrik, Paul's father, was 6 years old at the time. They were forced out of Der Chimucha, at which time the villagers made for the manor house, pulling out all the window frames, throwing out all the books outside, tearing them to shreds. Looters left nothing here. That's the second time he lost his house. They found safety in Belarus and another area in Belarus, and after the war was over, they actually returned to Der Chimucha to try to reestablish themselves. But and they were protected by the German army there. But unfortunately, in November of that year, within just a year, the Russians forced them out, and they lost the home finally. And that was for the last time, Der Chimucha. So by the age of 7, Henry had lost his first home through fire, the family estate he lost twice because of the war, and unfortunately, this won't be the last home he loses to war. While Henry's personal narrative is full of intrigue, it's critical to remember what Schustenberger observed. And let me repeat that historical wounds remain open wounds, and I can think of no better place than Poland, where this assertion is so noticeably evident. But let's just keep going. Oh, you're going here. Yes, so here's Magdalena and Antoni. And this is presume an engagement photograph. This is after the war, this is when they're in Warsaw. So this couple who had this estate, with them here is a little boy called Adam Kinievich, and he was the son of the brother Stash, right? Was it Stash?
Kasia.
These two people were reduced to two rooms at the end of their life. They lived in one room, and the woman who helped them, they both had dementia, she lived in the second room, and that's how they died. Very sad, tragic ending. Okay, let's look at the next one. Who do we have? Hubba.
Yes, I know.
Here are the four brothers. So, let me see if I can remember. Okay, this is Hieronym, right?
Yes.
Hieronym, Henry, Kajo, and...
My father.
Yeah. No. This is Stefan Hieronym. Stefan was the Poland's national historian. And he's still, every child in Poland reads his history books because he wrote prolifically. So those are the four brothers. This is Magdalena with three of the boys. This is Kajo, this is Hieronym, and this is
Stefan.
So the historian.
Gore's uncles.
Yes, those are my uncles.
Uncles. Not great.
Those are my uncles.
Uncles, just uncles.
Your father's brothers.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, what's the next one? This is Ruzhcha. So, after the war, before the, in 1939, in June, Henry and Rose were married. And this was the house that was that was her dowry, and this is where they lived. This house is just outside of Krakow, and I would suggest it looks about like this on the left still. It's family property. It's the young man who's taking over, of course, Angie, or has taken over from his father, Michael Popiel, he is now taking over Rushta and trying to do something with it, with our blessing. We're too old. 1850, this is a painting of Rushta, which if you go into the museum in Corsica, you'll see that painting. So this was Henry and Rose's house at the war, where they were blissfully looking forward to their life together, raising children, and Henry, the estate manager. Okay. And these are the Popiel girls. This is Paul's mother, Rose. And behind is Korosvanky, because the family spent all their summers there.
That's where we're going in a couple of days.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't look anything like that, though, now. This was actually the moat, and it was filled with water in it, but it doesn't fill anymore. It was some kind of engineering problem.
Well, they're going to actually restore that, the moat.
But anyway, this was Rose's auntie who lived there. Okay.
That's where Sophia
came from.
Radziwill came from. Krzysztof's wife, she came from Korosvanky. I think, is that the last one we have?
No.
No.
This is Henry and Rose on their wedding day.
June 1939.
Yeah. This is Henry and Rose establishing themselves at Rushta. And here at the end, you see a picture of them before the war.
Uncle Henry used to be beautiful.
Yes, he was a Polish officer, and actually he, Paul's father, so he was in uniform, and he went into Krakow, I guess, in August of 1939. The Polish army was pulling everybody together. He said goodbye to his wife, who cried and cried at the platform. They didn't see each other for another 6 years. Fortunately, he was caught on the west side of the Vistula River. So he was taken into prison, POW, by the Germans. On the east side, the Russians, who took the Polish soldiers, 20,000 of them, were all killed at Katyn.
Or Baba Yar.
Or what?
They were killed at Baba Yar.
I don't know where that
Baba
is.
Baba Yar in Russia.
I see. Yes. Well, so yes.
That was another atrocity, yes.
Yes. Yeshenko.
Okay, do we have anything else? If not, I just wanted to really just summarize just do we have any more? I don't know. No, that's it. Okay, good. So now Henry's story is just one of millions displaced by shifting borders, war, uprisings, and finally the Holocaust. So if you look at Poland as an individual, this trauma is still suffered. This feeling of rootlessness is only assuaged by an exaggerated patriotism, which of course leads to nationalism, which leads to more disruption. There is a feeling of paranoia that the Germans and the Russians are still out to get them, which leads to uncertainty. And this is current Poland, I would have to say, where there's still all of these feelings just about this feeling of being unsettled. And this is in a family, you can see the arc of this refugee, this forced exile into refugee status. You can see the arc of this over five generations, and I find it extraordinary that each generation carries with it this sense. And now you have this fifth generation, it's third generation from the war, well, Paul's second generation from the war, but even the third generation children who've grown now, they're adults, we're all working together to restore these homes. Each one of us have, I think, our own agenda in the sense that we see them working for Poland perhaps in a different way. Paul and I, in terms of an educational center, I think Korosvanky is more for children and that sort of thing, weddings and for the community.
Sense of place, and you just need to look at
this restored and then look at that to see that's part of the loss. And that's why I was left with this sort of sense of loss. And being deprived of your lifestyle, your life in a sense. And just imagine people arriving and just taking you away.
Rose said to me, she said, if somebody had said to me, you will have to leave Poland and be living in Scotland for the rest of your life, I would have said, you were from the moon.
Yeah.
Because they just did. They just walked you and took everything.
Yeah.
And made you homeless.
Because in various large houses in Scotland, there were Polish refugees, mm-hmm. including my grandparents, based in Forfar. And I think that it was empty. And then my mother then went there. My grandparents tried to escape from the Blitz. It was then they were in Richmond, London. And so in 1943, my grandmother said, we're just going to go to Scotland. Because my great-grandmother had died. And the house, the trustees said, we don't want anybody living in the house, it's not fit to live in. It's an enormous house. And so they instead, so without permission of the trustees, they 20 suitcases put into the sleeper, all they went up to Scotland. And then my mother had to climb up the drain pipe into the house through a window. And then you could open the door from the inside. And so she was 10. And so she was, and then after my grandfather died, just in 1945, and the whole place was sold up, the roof was taken off, now it's a complete ruin. So that's just another.
It's another narrative.
Yeah, another narrative to feed
into.
Because of war, yes, anyway, it's open to, you've got...
At the very end, you said that Paul's family is just one of hundreds of thousands in home. And you said something about, I just want to check I've understood, because it's a question I've lived in the end. That leads to nationalism, excessive passion for doing stuff like promoting Christianity. And worse, and I wondered if it's your thought that by creating an environment such as this, you're setting the scene of catalyst for cultural healing. Is that right?
Yeah, what I was saying is that the sense of ruthlessness and uncertainty causes one to become an exaggerated patriot, which, oh, this is Poland, this is the best, this is the best country, we have the best food, we know everything, we're better than all the other countries in Europe, and so forth. And this causes nationalism like we see in America now. It causes nationalism that we don't want to encourage. What we're doing here is not, you can't go back, but you can't leave anything behind. So there's a paradox. You can't go back, but you can't leave anything behind, or be careful what you leave behind. So we are attempting to restore the aesthetics, music, art, philosophy, psychology now in the 21st century, or 20th century, just bringing all this together as we're doing today, just gathering, talking, sharing story and so forth, in order to bring, as you say, re-enliven or regenerate the space. We're not interested in going back and being, landed gentry and having people, darn our socks, we're not interested in that at all. We're interested in just the features that are worth saving, which is art.
The legacy of slavery, which 15 million people were taken forcibly from Africa to go to Brazil and obviously the plantations, all they could able to bring with them was music, which is why when we go to Africa, they have
that's what, collectively, that's what never seems to die. And that's what we want to continue to nourish.
John?
If you know about Henning, a German missionary to the Zulus who brought back to Germany, now on the worldwide, family constellation beacon.
Well, yes, Bert Hellinger, and he was coming up this week for me, so I need to really look at him more carefully.
I've been doing this now for 14 years at this country, and if anybody wants a taster, just let me in a break, we can do a taster.
John is a facilitator.
I hear that, yes. I may be grabbing you.
Anybody can grab me, it's a wonderful way of healing. But my question basically is whether you, Amber, know your roots, because presumably you're an immigrant to Texas, and did you come from Berlin, or some of your ancestors?
No, I come from Texas. I do know my story. I have a story, and I know it, but it's very personal, and I just didn't think it's okay. Appropriate to...
I'm just intrigued as to clearly your risk.
When one knows the story, it's absolutely crystal clear why I'm here. But anyway, it's very personal. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
Now, as you've how you adopted very much, you know, Paul's family, your knowledge of it, and the people, and the
And you can speak Polish.
Well, it's just learning.
Yeah. This could be, and this must be ancestral.
Ancestral or reincarnated or something, I don't know, yeah. I'm pretty much convinced of that.
Karmic.
Karmic, yeah. Thank you so much.
Brain conference, and then also something that, oh, I can't
can't remember the American guy's name, slightly wacky guy, Fred Dean's